Welcome to the Wagon Wheel. I am Jared Kimber. This is the podcast where we talk, we think. Well, sometimes we think, sometimes we just answer without thinking. Questions about cricket. The best way to do it is if you're on the YouTube channel live now, where I think Jessica was in there and maybe a couple of others as well. The best way of doing it is putting a YouTube question in, and a super chat is the one that I will absolutely be guaranteed to do because you've given me money and that's how life works. But if you want, just listen to this as a normal podcast, like a normal person, not a YouTube person, Patreon is the best way of doing it. So we have patreon.com/Jared Kimber. We have lots of questions on Patreon, including this one from Jack, who says, to what extent are specialist wicketkeepers valuable in this T20 World Cup? And who do you see as a proper specialist? This is in response to New Zealand media savaging Devin Conway versus Afghanistan. He didn't have a good game, did he? I think that's probably fair to say. Look, the truth is, Jack, we don't know how important specialist wicketkeepers are because we don't have any proper metrics on wicketkeeping. Cricviz keep some stats based on, you know, kind of what their analysts have a look at, but I've seen it before. It's very subjective, and I think there are a lot of wicketkeepers who don't dive a lot, who get seen as a lot better than wicketkeepers who do dive. So generally, a great wicketkeeper is more likely to drop more catches because they can actually get to more catches because of their footwork, right? So it is very, very tough. I think if we were to use Hawkeye data with it, and I don't know if they could do that, but we could probably work out stumpings and catches at the stumps quite easily. I don't know if we can use Hawkeye data all the way through the wicketkeepers at the moment, but eventually spatial tracking will come in. But the truth is, I think they're really important, but we don't have any data that tells us about that either way. So we're kind of stuck in the dark a little bit. Jessica's everywhere. During a Reading career interview, AB de Villiers said that when talking with players who were less talented than himself, he always try hard to stay realistic, to emphasize and understand them. In the past, you previously said that Kevin Peterson really struggled to empathize with players who were less talented than he was, and he would often give them awful advice. Not sure I ever said that, but I think that's roughly true. In your experience talking about and with top cricketers, do more of them behave like de Villiers or Peterson? I think, so someone like AB de Villiers is probably more a coach. He has that normal empathy and, trying to understand where players are, whereas Kevin Peterson and Garfield Sobers, I mean, Garfield Sobers kind of was asked quite a bit, and I've done a lot of research of this for my book, and he was asked for quite a bit of advice, and he gave advice, but it was just advice that didn't help other players. There's actually a great story with Mark Waugh, which I asked Mark Waugh about, and he doesn't remember, but I think Brad Haddin talked about it on a podcast where they were facing a left-arm finger spinner, and Brad Haddin just couldn't get him away. And Mark Waugh said, well, just come down the wicket and hit him over cover. So you see this everywhere. And it's something that I try and I'm lucky enough to come from a family of educators. And so, you know, my mum's a librarian. My dad was a cricket coach. You know, a lot of my aunties and uncles were teachers. And so I saw that a lot, even more so than just going to school and being with coaches. And so you kind of understand that you have to play with people on different levels. Not everyone sees the world that way, right? And I don't think that makes AB de Villiers a better person than Kevin Peterson. Kevin Peterson just doesn't understand why another person can't do what he does. So your overall question is really interesting. I think there are certainly a lot of peak players. It was something that Rahul Dravid talked to me about a lot as well in my chat with him, where he was basically saying that at a certain point, the great players can't always explain why they are great. And it's a really interesting one. And I have found I've talked to some really interesting players that are sort of slightly lower down. They're really good players like Chris Rogers and Jimmy Adams were two great interviews that I had for my book. And they were much better at explaining sometimes the other players than the players themselves were. And so you do get a Kumar Sangakkara or Rahul Dravid who are very good, or AB de Villiers who are empathetic and understand that this player's on a different level and you need to explain it in a different way. But then you get a lot of other players who are like, well, he should simply not do that, right? He should simply hit that ball for four. I don't understand why he didn't hit that ball for four. The Virender Sehwag model. So I don't think there's like a pattern. Some people are able to see what they do and what someone else does and the differences between them. And a lot of, and this isn't just the cricket thing, of course, and a lot of people aren't. So we're talking about the top, 0.1% of batting in the world. And I also think it comes to where they are. Like, if you look at de Villiers, he's very different than Peterson. And one of the things he's very different about is he has a very clear, I'm going to take this from this player, I'm going to take this from this player, and he's constantly learning and putting together, you know, a little bit from Virat here and a little bit from Lance Klusner here and a little bit from Gary Kirsten and Hansi Kronier and Jonty Rhodes. And I'm going to bring together this whole piece, and that's going to be me, AB de Villiers, as a batter. You look at Kevin Peterson or Brian Lara, and I think those are probably players that are just themselves. And you know, there almost isn't a way for them to explain it as well. So it's a fascinating question. I hope I've answered it well. Addy says, who is the cricketer with the least cricketing intelligence match awareness you have seen? Can you understand if you don't want to name names or tell incidents? Ask deep strike farming against Hardik's prompted this question. Best I've seen is Bumrah and Rashid Khan. Worst being Jadeja and Pakistan in Super Over versus USA. Look, I think there's a lot of young bowlers who come through who are really good athletically. Someone like Mohammad Siraj is a perfect example of this. Nuwan Pradeep was another one in Sri Lanka. They don't really know that much about cricket. Dirk Nannis, even like an older player who didn't really devote his life to cricket. When I watched him when he was young, he didn't know things, you know, very, very basic things. And it's generally athletic bowlers that have that problem because their athleticism has carried them into the game. And Mohammad Siraj's best ball is as great as anyone's best ball in the world. But, you know, you watch early Mohammad Siraj and he didn't know the LBW laws, right? Nuwan Pradeep once hooked his own stumps down with a bat, you know, and you see that a lot. Whereas a spinner, even if they do bizarre things, and Murali and Stuart McGill are two that come to mind who did bizarre things when they were batting and fielding at times, I always felt with players like that, that there was certainly still an understanding of cricket in a way that we don't see with the faster bowlers. So it's usually those faster bowlers. And quite often they don't have the same sort of backgrounds as other players. Being very fast and reasonably accurate enough to get yourself to international level is enough for, you know, if you can bowl 88 miles an hour and hit a decent-ish line and length, you're probably going to play international cricket at a certain point, right? So there's probably some things in their education that doesn't always work. But the other thing that you're talking about here is sometimes you see players who are in the, who just, they don't, what's the best way of putting it? Like if you see a tail ender batting out in the middle and they're making bad mistakes, like you're talking about with Ashdeep, he's made 74 professional runs before that in T20 cricket, right? How many times has he been in that situation? Now, maybe he was a slightly better bat when he was a kid, but generally most tail enders are, you know, have not done the batting hours. So they're doing something that they haven't done all that often. So it makes sense that they would make some errors. And you see this with part-time bowlers as well. Part-time bowlers just try too much, right? You've got a good delivery that works as a part-time bowler. Go with that. And instead they bowl a different delivery every single ball because they don't think like bowlers. So I do think there's a big issue with that sort of stuff overall. Jessica says, Stephen Jay Gould, but I didn't think we'd be starting. Is he the guy that founded Skeptic magazine? Skeptic Society? One of those, isn't he? He wrote the following about baseball fans' prejudiced thinking habits when they tried to analyze their sports history. We sit in our unsatisfactory present, surrounded by two mythologies that exalt the respective and conflicting ends, better futures by the fancy of progress and rosier past of the fable of the golden good old days. Do you think cricket fans suffer from something similar to this? So I remember, and I don't know if it's on the podcast we did with Wright Thompson, but I remember having a chat with Wright Thompson about cricket, the famous ESPN writer. And I remember having a chat with him one stage, and he was trying to work out Lords. It might have been when we were at Lords, or might have even been afterwards. I can't remember, but we're having this big chat, and he was trying to work out Lords, and he said, it reminds me of country music, of Lords is trying to create this environment, and Test cricket is trying to create this environment as well, of this thing that never quite existed, and that country music actually is a lot of people who were brought up in the country, who moved to a city, and then sang about how great the country was. And Test cricket is, and traditional cricket, I should say, is very similar to that, right? There is a lot of, oh, it was better in when. And when you actually break it down and what they're saying, you know, I remember when I was young, you know, people would go on and on about how great cricket was in the you know, 60s and 70s. There were hardly any teams. There was hardly any cricket played. You couldn't see it on TV, right? Like, just very basic things. And like, you break down it very similar, and it's like, well, that's just normal nostalgia, right? You liked it because of the age that it was in. And I think there are country music, baseball, cricket, are three examples, and there are lots of them in life, where there's this feeling that they're old-fashioned. And so because of that, we pine for the good old days, right? And when I did Death of a Gentleman, and we would go and do talks around the country, people would say things like, oh, we should go back to the amateur days. That would solve all this problem. What? Amateurism was an absolute sham, right? And if you look at the spirit of cricket's really interesting because it really becomes a big deal after World War II, right? And there's this whole push back towards the spirit of cricket at that point. And they are harking towards a time when cricket was wild, right? W.G. Grace was just running his stuff however he wanted to. Amateurs were just completely, you know, taking the piss everywhere. The Australian cricket team went on strike because they weren't played correctly. The first Australian cricket team to tour as an Australian cricket team, so after the Indigenous team, although the Indigenous team counts very similar as well. But the second team went as a co-op, like a union, and went and played, right? This whole idea that cricket was played for the spirit or whatever else, there's no proof of that anywhere within the old histories of the game. And yet somehow in that early 1950s, as professionalism starts to take over and it does become more of a professional sport, there's this harking back to, no, it's not just about professionalism, you know. And again, it's this harking back. So I think there is an element of that within cricket that is always there. Ben King says, who are your top five under 25? I mean, the problem with a question like that, Ben, is I would need to remember who on earth is under 25. And I actually saw this question come in early and I still couldn't quite work out who my list would be at the moment. I suppose you would have Jaiswal, Fraser McGurk. Who else would you chuck in there? How old's Rachin Ravindra? Is he still under 25? Rachin Ravindra age? he's 24. Okay, so he just sneaks in. Who have we got bowlers-wise? Nassim Shah, I suppose you would have him in there as well. And would you have Marco Janssen? Would be another one off the top of my head. That feels like a pretty strong list. I'm trying to think if there's anyone else out there. I'm sure if I could actually think of people who are, you know, under the age of 25 over the last couple of years, that would help me quite a bit. You know, off the top of my head, that feels like a good list. I'm in on that. Let's go from there. John says, why has cricket not developed a method for counteracting dew? So my first question would be, John, is has the world worked out a method for counteracting dew? Like, I'm just going to Google it live on air. How to stop dew? How to stop condensation? So that's slightly different. Yeah, I don't see anything here that suggests that would be the case. So if you go back, John, to the history of cricket, our pitches were absolutely terrible because we were putting manure on them to grow them, which meant that there were little turds on the wicket, right? And the ball would often hit that and react really poorly. Then the farming industry comes in with muck spreaders and all those muck things that liquidize manure and spray it out evenly. And so, of course, that's, you see the batting averages go up year after year after that. It has nothing to do with cricket, right? Someone else invented it for their reasons. Cricket hasn't invented that many things for itself. Hawkeye would actually be one of the few things, which is an incredibly important invention made by a cricketer for cricketers. But cricket hasn't really invented all that many things. Generally, it's been the outside world that has been doing that. And I have no idea when I ask this question out loud, does the outside world actually need a method for counteracting dew, right? So then the second thing is, how do you stop dew? Like, how do you actually stop moisture swelling up? Like, from a scientific point of view, how do you stop the weather? That would be my guess. I would assume if we had indoor stadiums, and I am only assuming, I don't know if this is, if dew is a problem at the Docklands, for instance, but I would assume in an indoor stadium, this probably isn't an issue. So it's completely an outdoor one. So if you really want to know how to counteract dew, I would say it would be indoor stadium. But there might be other ways. They try special sprays, and I know people who kind of think they work a little bit. And I know a lot of people are like, yeah, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. We just tell the players that it works. I think it's a much bigger problem than what cricket would be able to solve. But we are in an age now where there's a lot of young scientists who are massive cricket fans. Maybe that is something for them. You know, I know there was a couple of young Pakistani kids who tried to work out how we could in-game test people's bowling actions, right? You know, and Hawkeye, as we were talking about before. So sometimes cricket fans do get together, but it would have to be cricket fans. The ICC's not got the money to do this. I would kind of think that the IPL might look into it in the future just because it doesn't, well, it makes the game's a little bit more predictable, and that's not exactly what they want. On the other side of that, does it not give more fours and sixes? Do you really want to legislate against fours and sixes? Us as cricket fans might, but do they want to, I suppose, is what I'm saying. Anyway, let's have a quick break here on the Wagon Wheel, and we will be back in a moment with more cricket. And thanks to Nord for coming back in for more sponsorship as well. And just to celebrate that, I'll show one of their old ads. Cricket 8 brings you this show. They are analysing every part of our game. Head over for their watch-alongs, podcasts and articles on what is really happening on the field and why it matters. Cricket8.com is your place for cricket intelligence. Welcome back. I don't know if anyone can hear the excessive purring that is happening here. And I don't like it when cats purr. That's not because it's not nice or anything. It's just that it's a lie, right? They just do it for humans, for attention. I would give the cat attention anyway. I don't need the loud purring. Welcome back to the Wagon Wheel. Rudra says, a team of Alex Hales, Michael Lum, Moen, Morgan, Butler, Bapara, Brosnan, Jordan, Broad, Treadwell, and Stephen Parry, I don't remember who this is, was pulled out for 88 by the Netherlands in 2014 World T20. And England were awful in that tournament. But on paper, doesn't that team actually look okay? Lots of bowling options, at least chaos hitting down to number 9, some great hitters up the order. Yeah, the issue was, which the players have talked about since, it's that they weren't being allowed off the chain. So if you go back and have a look at some of their strike rates in Pro 40 cricket's the best one, but T20 cricket as well for someone like Butler, it was all there. Moen Ali was another one. I haven't looked at Lum, but Hales, Moen, Morgan, Butler, and I'm not sure about Bopara. But the other guys were all just absolutely smashing the ball in Pro 40 cricket. And I think I've done a big video on that one before. I wrote an article for The Cricketer about it once. It's really fascinating how good those guys were doing in that. But when they got to the England environment, they were all afraid of being dropped. They were all in a situation where they didn't feel particularly comfortable and they weren't being let to play the way that they did. So that's what Owen Morgan was saying in 2015 when he took over the side from Alistair Cook in the one-day cricket. He got both jobs, but I think there was the one-day World Cup straight after that. He was saying that they weren't put in an environment where they felt comfortable. And so what Owen Morgan did is he sort of picked, you know, the 15 or 16 players he thought could change things and then just said to them, look, we're not going to drop you. We're going to let you play the way you play. This is what we're going to do. And let's see how we go from there. So that is the bigger change. And some, you know, we've seen a similar thing with other teams before. The West Indies fast bowling is a very similar one, right? West Indies didn't suddenly get fast bowlers in 1976. They had been growing more and more fast bowlers for a long time, but they were still picking medium paces. They were still very spin dependent and everything else. And what Clive Lloyd says is, well, isn't this our strength? Isn't our strength just that we have four guys who can bowl really, really fast and keep the pressure on? And so they changed the game there. And that's the difference, right? Sometimes it's unlocking the talent within your side. And that's one of the big things, I think, when you are talking to coaches about, you know, and interviewing coaches should be saying, well, this is our squad and what do we want to do? And I think what McCullum said to England, and I'm just reading between the lines here, but, you know, from hearsay and things like that, I think what McCullum said was, we're not very good at red ball batting, so why don't we let your white ball batters bat like white ball cricket in red ball cricket? Sometimes that sort of thing can unlock players in a different way. We know that baseball hasn't been you know, a runaway success, but it certainly changed the way that they have played, and they put pressure back on the opposition now. They weren't putting any pressure on the opposition before with the bat. Ian says, is a maiden as valuable as a wicket in a T20 power play? No. So the expected runs in a T20 power play is probably, it depends which over you're talking about, but on mass, I think it would be about 8.6 to 9 overall. I think I'm right in that. I'd have to go back and look at the proper mass for you, Ian. But it's about 8.6 to 9. Depending on when you lose the wicket in the power play, I think in the first two overs, it can take somewhere around 20 runs off your expected total. And I'm not sure what it is afterwards, but I would say it's still more than 8.9. One of the best ways of doing having a look at this, Ian, is, and it is different for different teams, but if you look at two decently evenly managed sides, both of which you have, you know, batting down to number 7 and maybe someone who can hit at number 8, and you have a look at the betting exchange markets when a wicket falls on the expected runs total, you can see the difference. Whereas a maiden will bring it down about 8 runs, and it might be that the wicket might bring it down 15 or 20, 25, depending on the player sometimes and all sorts of things. And especially because a lot of teams are top loaded, right? With their players. So there are some teams where it might even be more so because they're so opener dependent. I'm trying to think of a team. Well, Afghanistan would be a perfect example. Now, if Afghanistan lose an early wicket, you're probably not expecting them to make their full quota of runs. Doesn't mean that they won't, but over 50 games, they're so dependent on their two openers that can cause some issues. Ruja says, which teams in the current T20 World Cup would be the best test teams? I haven't even thought about that. I suppose Australia's bowling lineup's pretty similar, isn't it? Might change the batting order around a little bit, but Travis Head might even feel comfortable opening at the moment. That one makes the most sense to me. What about India? You've got Kuldeep, Siraj, Bumrah, and then Jadeja, Akshar. Yeah, so that's the bowling lineup is done. South Africa's bowling lineup is pretty similar to their test bowling lineup again, isn't it? Off the top of my head anyway. So anyone that has a sort of a test bowling lineup rather than T20 specialists is going to be in a pretty good situation. Those are the ones off the top of my head. Sri Lanka's an interesting one because I don't know how Pathirana would go in test cricket, but if you had Madashankar and Pathirana with Hasaranga and do they have the other spinner? They have the left arm finger spinner around? They don't really have an off spinner, but I suppose they have Dan and Jaya. That's another one that maybe is on the verges of being quite good as well. It's certainly got a lot of good bowlers. So it would be that, I would have thought. And then with the batters, kind of make it up with whoever you have left. It's more important to be able to take 20 wickets than anything else in a test match. That's how you win test matches, I believe. Prashant says, loved your conversation with AB. I was really fascinated by the fact he had to keep bullshitting himself to play some of his more amazing knocks. How big a factor is this in other batters of his S-tier level class? Does this hold true for other batters in B-tier who play a couple of extraordinary innings but are never consistently able to do it? So Mark Butcher's one of my favourite stories on this, where Mark Butcher changed his entire personality to be more successful in test cricket. And essentially what he did for a couple of years, and I don't think he's ever released a book on this, but I'm sure one day he'll get around to it. But essentially he just made himself into a star. Wouldn't carry his own bags, you know, put the sunglasses on, you know, hung out with famous people, started seeing. But he needed to do that to. Oh. Why has my cat done that to me? Thank you, Rodan. he needed to do that to get himself to a level where he felt like he belonged. And, you know, I've talked to Butch quite a bit. And one of the things he told me years ago was when he just didn't feel comfortable when he was out in the middle in test cricket because he didn't feel like he belonged. So he kind of tricked himself to feeling that way. And you go through a lot of Australian cricketers that have said similar kinds of things before of like, they weren't sure if they were ready, but they just convinced themselves that they were. And then they went out there and they played the innings. And once you've played the innings, you feel more comfortable anyway. So I do think that is a big part of it of, you know, sort of, it's one reason why I recently had some contact from some players who weren't happy with something that I had done. And they were like, you know, you didn't get this right, or this wasn't what we believed, blah, blah, blah. And they were going through a few things. And I was like, but my job isn't to write and make stuff for you. My job is to make stuff for the audience. And this is how I saw it. And this is the evidence that I had in front of me. And this is the conclusions that I drew from that. It's okay for you to feel differently. You should feel differently. In fact, when I'm working with players, that's one of the big things I'm worried about. I don't want to say the thing that gets them into a negative space, right? I want to put it to them in a situation that allows them to be helped and everything else. And actually, sometimes even the opposite. Remember, there was one player that I could see he was going through an issue and he asked for guidance. And there wasn't a technical reason. I think he just had lost confidence. And I said, just hit more sixes. And he sort of laughed for a bit. And I went, I'm not joking. You're at your best when you hit sixes. Go back into the nets and practice trying to hit as many sixes. And the next game, when there's an opportunity to hit a six and you'll feel better, right? I don't know if that helped him at all or if it had any impact, but me going through the technical side of thing and that stage wouldn't have worked. What he needed was that, right? He just needed to feel good about himself. And I can't remember who it was. I think it was Dennis Lilly talking about Mitchell Johnson when Mitchell Johnson went through a dip in his form. And Cricket Australia wanted Dennis Lilly to work with him. He's like, he doesn't bowl the way. I don't know what I'm going to do with this guy. He's got this weird action, blah, blah, blah. And then eventually Dennis Lilly just sort of went, I'm just going to tell him how good he is. And he did. And he told him over and over again how good he was. And because it was Dennis Lilly telling Mitchell Johnson how good he was, Mitchell Johnson started to believe. And I think, Mitch have talked about this before. He probably had imposter syndrome a little bit and he needed that, right? Sometimes you just need to feel that that is who you are. And we see it a lot in professional sports. Ali says, according to you, what would be the ideal number of teams in World T20, ODI, and hypothetical World Test Championship tournament? Well, I would have 32. I don't think you'd have 32 in the Test Championship. I think Test Championship would be leagues. So it'd be, you know, Division 1, Division 2, Division 3, Division 4, Division 5. T20 World Cup, I would probably want to get to 32, which, you know, I don't know what the Basketball World Cup has. How many teams in the Basketball World Cup? Yeah, they have 32, and it's football, I would just hope, was roughly around the same. That kind of makes the most sense to me, having that number. One-day cricket, there probably aren't as many strong one-day cricket teams. Eventually, I'd want them to get to 32 as well, but you're probably looking at 16 in one-day cricket at the moment, you know, ramping up to 20, 24, and then moving on. But 32 is, that's a World Cup, isn't it? That's when all the teams that are the best in their regions come to an event. That's what a World Cup is supposed to be. I think a lot of people get very confused with World Cups. And then the idea is that you beat all those poor teams and you get to the top and then you beat the best teams and you win. You should have to qualify for an event because you shouldn't qualify for an event. My favorite one's always South Africa. You shouldn't qualify for a World Cup because in the 1890s, English people liked holidaying in Cape Town. Right? You shouldn't qualify for the World Cup because in 1930, they were worried about bringing in the West Indies and India and not having another Western team come in. So New Zealand come in early. Right? You shouldn't qualify for the World Cup for those reasons. You should qualify for the World Cup because you're really good at cricket, that you played really good cricket. And we're starting to get to that sort of element and more, and it's great to see. And that means that we will lose some teams at times, you know. Denmark and Kenya and those sorts of teams might have little peaks and then disappear. Who knows where Papua New Guinea will be in a couple of years. They've got an older side as well. But we will have other teams that will come up, right? Rwanda is another team that might come up. We had Singapore playing good cricket a couple of years ago. You know, Hong Kong were playing really good cricket. We might get other teams rising and falling. Vanuatu and making a big play for cricket. So let's keep doing that. Let's make everyone qualify and have proper events. We're a long way away from 32 at the moment, but that should be the aim of the ICC, right? I would have thought that's also, I'm just going to put it out there, 32 different TV markets. Bloody says, I recently watched highlights of 1997 India versus West Indies Trinidad ODI, obviously. Who hasn't? which included a 44 by Tendulkar and an 83 by Chandrapal. The shots played were like a test match. Appropriately, the match was played in white with a red ball on an explosive seeming pitch. Tendulkar might be the greatest ODI batter, but how do you consider Chandrapal? Yeah, so I talked to a couple of people about Chandrapal recently for my book. I sent him a message. Unfortunately, he was not available to do the book himself. But I talked to a few people. They all felt like Chandrapal had many gears available to him that he never really got to. And we know he has that incredible innings in the test match against Australia. Was it 50, no, 60 ball, 100 or whatever it was, 57 ball? I can't remember that number now. But, you know, one of the fastest test hundreds of all time. And a lot of the people said that his upbringing and the way he thought about cricket really restricted his scoring rate. He made a conscious choice to be the Shivnarine Chandrapal that we saw. And so one day cricket, he had a strike rate of 70, which I think for his era was low, but it wasn't like, you know, this couple of years ago when Shai Hope had a strike rate like that when everyone else was at 90, right? Like, it wasn't quite like that for Chandrapal. I know he really struggled in T20s, but they were in the back part of his career when he really got defensively minded. I think if Chandrapal came through now with the same skills that he had, he would probably just score at a quicker rate just because cricket has opened up a little bit. But I do think the way that he thought about cricket and the way his father trained him about cricket probably limited him, but he was still a very good middle overs player because he wasn't going to get out to spin all that much and he could rotate the strike and could find boundaries when he wanted to and would bat for a long time. Like, he averaged 40 in ODI cricket. He could certainly play. Let's just have another quick break here on Wagon Wheel, and we'll be back with more Wagons and Wheels after this. This is brought to you by Cricket 8, cricket intelligence for you every day. Scott says, who would be in your associate test 11? You can pick any current or non-current associate players. However, only players from current associate nations. Oh, so no Irish or Afghanistan, that's fair. So no players who previously or later played in tests for their nations. I suppose you would have, I've forgotten his name. Steve Tokolo would be up the top of my hand. IL from Kenya. IL Bueller would be interesting from Fiji. What was the Dutch, old West Indian guy who played for the Dutch when he was like 50, whose name I've now forgotten. Callum McLeod would certainly be in that team. Probably Kyle Kutzer as well. I'm trying to think of other batters. So what have I got? I've got about five batters there. Missing someone obvious in this, aren't I? So I've got, yeah, and then I suppose the Dutch players, it's, you know, I mean, you would have Tendulkar, right? But I don't know if you quite count him for this, Scott, but he would certainly be in that team. Okay, so we've got that. Then we need, I'd almost be Baz de Leeuw as my all-rounder. I think he would be quite interesting. Paul van Meekeren as a fast bowler. I'm trying to think of some of the older. What is the name of the Danish cricketer? Ollie Mortensen. Is that his name? Yeah, Ollie Mortensen. So let's just have a look. What did he do in first-class cricket? 157 games, 434 wickets, an average of 24. Okay, put him in. So I've got him and Van Meekeren. I'm going to go Asif Karim, probably as my captain and as my bowler, just partly because I love Asif Karim, but I also thought he was a beautiful bowler. I want a wrist spinner. Colin Dubois is an interesting one as a wrist spinner. Michael Rippon as a left-arm wrist spinner from the Dutch, but he plays for New Zealand now, so that's kind of ruined. I'm trying to think if I've got any other older wrist spinners. Colin Dubois, when he was young, was incredible. I'm not quite sure he's at that level, and I can't think of any other wrist spinners. I suppose Sandeep Lamachani would be the other one, wouldn't he? I mean, you kind of may not want to pick him for moral reasons at the moment, but he would be another one. But that's pretty good lineup. I've got five bowlers in there. I've got some decent batters. I'm not sure who they beat. I think I'm missing probably some other players from history, but off the top of my head as a non-associate expert, I'm more or less not terrified with that team. Nadika says, soccer journalists for The Athletic are contractually forbidden from betting on soccer. Okay. Do major cricket outlets ban their direct employees from betting on cricket? I've never heard of it. I wouldn't be surprised if there were some places that did it. It's interesting because The Athletic have a lot of betting content now as well, don't they? I've never heard of an organization that has a ban. I know there are some journalists that have been told not to do it. I know that journalists are being encouraged not to do it in press boxes to the point at which you can't use certain betting sites in the press boxes, certainly in the UK, because of court siding and things like that. I've certainly heard those stories before, but I don't think their bosses told them not to bet, although they might have. But yeah, I certainly have never been told that. I mean, I didn't bet, so maybe it wasn't an issue back then, but I've never heard of that one before, no. But it doesn't mean it hasn't happened. Ubik says, do you think Pat Cummins' missing fingertip significantly changes the way he bowls? It's interesting, isn't it? You know, Warne had, you know, a problem when he was young and got very strong in the shoulders. And, you know, Murali has this elbow. Jofra Archer, Jasprit Bumrah both have similar kinds of elbows. You know, so there is something to be said for being an incredible bowler with some kind of physical deformity that enhances it. Whether Pat Cummins, the ball comes out of his fingers slightly different than it might for another bowler, it's hard. I don't know if that's something that we can scientifically prove or not. I know he certainly talked about it before. I'm not sure if he has a definitive answer, let alone anyone else. I would assume it shouldn't make a big difference, but I can't be 100% on that. Ubik also says, what are the five best test wickets to play on in the past 5 years or more? Oh, that's a really interesting question, I suppose. What are the best five wickets? I don't know if I have a great answer for that one, Ubik. I don't know if I have even been thinking about it that way. I was thinking the other day, though, that there is a bunch of wickets who, like, were famously good that are not maybe as good as they used to be. And so, you know, in the old days, would you have, like, the Gabba and Adelaide Oval automatically in? And is the Gabba still the great cricket wicket it once was? It doesn't feel like it to me in the way that it used to. The Wacker no longer exists. So is Perth Stadium the Wacker? It's not quite, is it? The Wanderers is still pretty fun, isn't it? I think the Wanderers would be my number one. But yeah, then after that, I struggle a little bit to come up with a great list. Wanderers. And even then, I think I'm stretching that. I'm trying to think back to if I have seen great matches played on the Wanderers, or, you know, great surfaces from the Wanderers in the last couple of years. It's a fascinating question of which I have absolutely not answered. James says, what do you think Bumrah would have to do to become India's GOAT test pace bowler? I mean, he kind of is India's GOAT test pace bowler, isn't he? Like, already? Like, whatever he needs to do, he has done it. I don't think anyone, if you're just talking purely as a bowler, no one's picking Kapil Dev above him, right? And there isn't really anyone else all that close to what Bumrah has done. He needs 200 wickets. 200 wickets is the kind of cut off, I think. I would have thought, you know, guys like, what would Bob Willis have taken? Bob Willis took 325. Jeff Thompson wickets. He took 200 test wickets. Joel Garner test wickets. 259. Yeah, so I think 200 is the cutoff. I think at 200, you know, the ability to run in that many times and take test wickets at the sort of average a Bumrah currently has is incredible. If his average goes out to 22 or 23 and he has 200 wickets, he's still the GOAT Indian. The only thing you would make any issues at the moment is that he just has not played all that much. You know, he's only played 36 matches. So if he plays 50 matches, he takes 200 wickets and he's still averaging under 25, I think you would find it very hard for him not to be the automatic GOAT. But I think he's already the best seam bowler that India's ever had. Anurag says, how valuable do you think peak Yuvraj and Jayasuriya would have been? I think you might have asked this as a super chat, mate, and we answered it, but I think we answered it on a follow-up show. But yeah, Yuvi was a top wicket taker in a World Cup, and so he was frontline fourth and fifth bowler, probably a fifth bowler, but I see what you're saying. And you have extolled his virtues as a batter in your Indian number fours video. Yeah, I think they would be really important. I think Jayasuriya is probably a better bowler than Yuvraj, although late career Yuvraj became very good. But I think Jayasuriya was probably a bowler who became very good at batting. So if you had Jayasuriya in your side, you probably had batting down to number eight because you could have like a bowler who bats a little bit at number eight, 9, 10, 11. Yeah. So, you know, it would give you incredible flexibility to go in multiple ways. Whether either of them could bowl four overs a game consistently with the amount of left-handers we now have would be the only thing that would hold them back a little bit. But you're looking at solidly 2.5 overs each for both of them, I would have thought. And they're both quite canny and wily as well. So I'm not saying they would have done great against left-handers, and I don't have the stats to show it. Show me either way. But I think they would have worked out left-handers in a way, but they wouldn't have been on that sort of Jadeja, Akshar Patel level either, because I don't think they're as good as that. But yeah, I think they would have been fantastic. It would have given you incredible flexibility as a team to have them at their peak. Will says, would it not make more sense to have 24 sides in the World Cup so we could have a final set of group games take place at the same time? Yeah, I'm also okay with that. Will, you come up with a lot of these suggestions, and I think it's very important that you remember that sense is not exactly how these things are put together, as you can see by Sri Lanka's touring schedule and what Tikshana said about it. James says, what is your favourite hot mic commentary moment? Personally, I go with Tomo in the 97 Ashes, who was clearly early into an ad break on a rain delay and said, I am fucking drowning out here. That's a good one. Obviously, the Andrew Strauss one is quite famous. My favorite one is one that I don't know how many people ever heard this outside of me, but I did hear it and it made me laugh a lot. It was Australia, South Africa, and they're in South Africa, and there was a player that played for South Africa, which some of you might, like five of you may remember, a guy called Derek Crooks, who, let me see if I can find him here. Yeah, Derek Crooks. He's an all-rounder. And he played 32 ODIs. And he had 32 ODIs. He made 296 runs, an average of 15 with 150. And he took 25 wickets, an average of 40 with an economy rate of 5. So he wasn't particularly parsimonious for that era. He didn't take wickets and he didn't make runs. And these stats, I'm wondering if it was even his. Yeah, no, it was his international stats were shown up on the screen. And whoever the South African commentator was, I can't remember, but it might have been Haseman or Jackman or even a local South African at the time. But whoever the South African commentator was said, good all-rounder, Derek Crooks. I can bat a bit, can bowl a little bit, but mostly is a fantastic fielder. And then there was a break, and David Hooks, which I know is a bit confusing with Derek Crooks, but David Hooks, the former Australian player, was commentating, and you could hear him put his microphone down and say, and I'll paraphrase, but with a bowling average of 40 and a batting average of 15, he'd want to be able to fucking field. And it broke me. And I remember it must have been, I don't know, let's have a look. Let's see how far back we could take this when they played Australia. So he played Australia in the 90s. Yeah. Okay. So he played Australia in 1997. So when was that? What time of the year was that? In April. So I reckon I went to school the next day and told every single person, right? And told everyone at my career club. And like no one else heard it. I was just the only one who heard it. Maybe I had the sound up too loud or I had my headphones on or whatever it was. And I just happened to pick it up and it made me laugh. So yeah, definitely my favorite hot mic moment. All right, we'll take a quick break here, and then after the break, we'll get back to the comments in the YouTube super chats. I can't do the speaking at the moment. But this is Jared Kimber. This is The Wagon Wheel. This is brought to you by Cricket 8, the new home of cricket intelligence. All right, welcome back. There's quite a few chats in here, so let's get to all of those. Got some super chats as well, like from Anurag. Big super chat. Thank you very much, sir. With the intent India has been showing so far in this tournament, especially while batting, do you feel that this team is better than previous T20 Indian teams in terms of their approach? It's hard to say because we've only seen the New York pitch, right? But yes, I feel like Rahul Dravid has got them into a position where they feel like they need to go for it. What would have happened if they lost the Pakistan game is really interesting to me. That's when it changes. It's easy to go with your approach when you're winning, but if they do lose a crucial game, do things change? And I think that's very, very fair. And, you know, we see that sort of stuff all the time, right? Of it's all well and good for us to say, oh, you know, they're doing very, very well. But what happens when it switches and it goes in the other direction and the pressure changes? That's the one that we need to be prepared for with the Indian team, I think, at the moment. But yeah, they've Rishabh Pant, Rohit Sharma have certainly attacked early on and tried to put pressure back on and won them one game. They probably would have won the Ireland game anyway, but certainly won them the other game by scoring so much at the start. And that was what Pakistan could never really overcome. Saurabh says, what is your take on Bumrah opening the bowling for India in the World Cup? I don't see how it helps the team. At the moment, you've got Ashdeep bowling and you want him to bowl with a swinging ball. And you've got Siraj who needs a little bit more assistance off the seam. Bumrah doesn't need all of those things. The idea of having him bowl the third or fourth over is a threat as much as anything else. Maybe it makes the other teams go harder at your lesser bowlers. And if you do get into a position where you take one or two wickets, you can keep those other bowlers on or you can then bring him on as the hammer. It might change when they get to the Caribbean, where Siraj will take the new ball, but Ashdeep won't be playing. So they might actually use Bumrah occasionally for that. But yeah, I'm not. I would not be suggesting it if I was working for that team. Anurag says, do you think Pat Cummins can be in the conversation of all-time great Australian seamers alongside McGrath and Lilly by the end of his career? I think he's already in that conversation. If not, which bowler from the current Australian pastry do you think would have the best shot at being considered an all-time great? No, it's Cummins by far. His numbers, and you do deep dives into his numbers, they're very similar to McGrath's. And let me just look at something with Pat Cummins because I think this might be interesting as well. He did very well during he basically made his comeback during the pace bowling pandemic. So some of his numbers were slightly warped by that. But so he didn't have all the bad years that, that other bowlers and some of those other Australian bowlers had. And the last couple of years, he started averaging 27 and 25. And so it does suggest to me that he's not the force that he was. So if you have a look, he averages 20, 20, 17, 19, 22 in the years previous to that. He probably needs a few more years, you know, in the lower 20s, but even 24, 25, if he gets two or three more years there, you are going to be talking at, he's got 269 wickets. So you're talking about someone who's probably going to end his career with 300 wickets at around 24 at worst, right? If you compare that to Dennis Lilly, who also got, you know, bowled in a pretty good era for bowlers, especially some of those. Dennis Lilly had 355 wickets and an average of 23.92. So, and that's suggesting that Cummins isn't quite the bowler that he used to be. Cummins is incredible at being a chameleon, at just changing what he needs to do at a certain time. You know, if you compare him to Kagiso Rabada, I think you make a claim that both of them are absolutely all-time great bowlers. But Rabada is Rabada. Every time Rabada bowls, he's Rabada. And we've seen that on this South African, on this New York pitch, where Rabada's like, no, I'm still going to bowl like me. And it's like, maybe on this pitch, no, I'm Rabada and I bowl like Rabada. Cummins doesn't do that. And so his ability to evolve with the times, I think, is quite interesting from that point of view. And so with that, I believe that he can continue to push himself into that great conversation. I think Cummins' big issue, comparing him to McGrath, is that they're both as good against top order players as each other. And I haven't looked at Cummins in the last year, so maybe he slipped against them. But Cummins doesn't do as well against the tail as McGrath used to. So McGrath has a lower average because of that. But Cummins is still absolutely fantastic. Jessica says, your voice is going to be hoarse by the end of this afternoon. She's saying this because I have a podcast straight after on Scoreboard, or not even a podcast, another show on Scoreboard. Jessica, I do commentary And I've commentated entire games for 4 hours with me and one other person. And I do watch-alongs where we do two IPL games back-to-back. This is nothing. And I'd rather do them close together as well, because it sounds weird, but you kind of need to get your head in the right spot. And when you've got them both together, you're going a little bit in the right direction. But once you've worked in radio, everything else seems quite easy. Cyber Junkie says, are there any characteristics of T20 International Batting Order that can afford to play hit or miss batters like Maxwell, Fakhar Zaman, or Sky? So Glenn Maxwell, let's have a look at his record here. I think when we call someone a hit or miss player, he averages 29 in T20 internationals. That's a fairly consistent record, right? Now, I know what you mean. What you mean is some days he's Glenn Maxwell and some days he fails and everything else. Kind of most players do that. Fakhar Zaman in T20 internationals is different. He averages 23 and he hasn't been as successful. So with Fakhar Zaman, it's partly because of the positions he's been playing in, but that's a whole different conversation. You're looking at a different kind of player. But what you're doing with a player more like Fakhar Zaman, although I don't think he quite fits into this for many different reasons, but I think if you are looking at a player like that, what you are really putting yourself into is that you need to have an elongated batting order. So you need to have someone batting at number 8 in order to facilitate that. So it's the old Shaheen Afridi thing from the old days of, yeah, he can bat like a batter, but if you choose him like a batter, you actually end up with a situation where you half the time you don't have a number 6. So Sky, he's got a strike rate, an average of 43, and in domestic T20, it's even higher. So he's not hit and miss. He's consistently making runs. So it doesn't happen as much as you think, I suppose. Cyber Junkie is the best way of putting it. In fact, more often than not, those players are there because they make consistent runs. Asif Ali might be the sort of player that you're talking about. Asif Ali had all-rounders around him, is my memory of that. Keshav says, does Duckworth-Lewis method take into consideration the quality of teams? No, and it can't. I don't think that would be fair if it did that in that kind of a situation, because that team has done what it has done on that day. That is what Duckworth-Lewis is supposed to do. I think we could do a much better version of Duckworth-Lewis. I don't think it's fair to say, oh, well, this team usually would do this. And you used the Scotland one. So Scotland were 90 without loss. And they go to 109. They go into 109 because they haven't lost any wickets. England had the choice, the ability to take wickets and slow them down. If England were that much better than Scotland, they would have got the wickets, right? So it's unfair to go, oh, yeah, but normally Scotland wouldn't have batted this well. Doesn't matter. That's how well they batted in this game. It would be absolute carnage if you suddenly went, oh, no, we can't give them extra runs, but it's India, and India have won their last 8 games, so we're going to put on an extra 20 runs. No. India have lost wickets in this DLS, and so their DLS is lower. If India is that good, they will still defend this. That's how cricket works. Sankelp says, I don't know how much basketball is popular amongst Indian masses, but it surely has a niche following. Yep, I think that's pretty fair. What is basketball doing to expand non-traditional markets? Is it working? Can cricket learn anything? Okay, so the first thing that you need to know is that basketball isn't doing anything to expand into non-traditional markets. Right. What is happening is that the NBA, which is a business, is expanding into markets. So the NBA has made a big push into India over the last couple of years. Obviously, they make a big push into Africa and Australia and Asia in previous periods. It's been quite consistent for a long time, and they have been doing that because it's a business and they're trying to expand and get more customers. Basketball is a sport, right? Basketball as a sport is not trying to do that. Even FIBA, who run world basketball, they will facilitate India and they will help India and other Asian countries. Basketball, has some good followings in places like Sri Lanka as well. And, obviously in the subcontinent, I don't know as much, I don't have as many Pakistani friends who are basketball heads, although Usman Samiuddin is one. That I know follows basketball a little bit. That's the difference. Whereas cricket is not, so the ICC is in the same position as FIBA. they will facilitate and they will do stuff like that, but they're not a business. It is not their job to get more customers for cricket. It is an organization, right? And so it's very easy for the NBA to suddenly go, okay, we've got a couple of extra million here. Let's go and take some NBA players over and let's, you know, have academies right across Africa and let's have an NBA event in Melbourne, all right? Those sorts of things. The ICC, it's much harder for it to do all those sorts of things. And then basketball is a much easier thing to market because the players are much more well-known around the world. If, you know, if Chris Paul comes to India, and I think Chris Paul was one of the players who came to India, even if you're not a basketball fan, it's a big deal that Chris Paul is coming to India, right? That's not always the case with cricketers. And realistically, it's really Indian cricketers, a couple of Australian cricketers, and a couple of English cricketers. So you would be pushing those people. I think in some cases, they would be quite happy to be involved in that. So it's very, very different from that point of view. And we always have to remember that. When we look at American sports, we go, oh, the NFL's doing this, and Major League Baseball's doing this, and whatever. Those are not sporting organizations. Those are private businesses that run leagues, right? That's incredibly different. And that is an issue that we don't have that, but maybe the IPL will be the thing that eventually changes that within cricket. Anurag coming back in. Triple hit for Anurag? I think it's a triple hit. Anurag says, which one do you think is the greater of the two, Cummins or Bumrah? So this is a hard question to do because you haven't been specific. If you want to ask me a nerdish question, you need to get into the weeds. Right? What format? Do we factor in Cummins' batting and captaincy? Right? You really need to get into the weeds with that. If you're talking about all-format bowler, obviously Bumrah is the better bowler. Right? If you're talking about test bowling, I think Cummins is more tested and, you know, is more useful in more places at the moment. But I don't think that means a Bumrah can't be on that level or even above that level. But if you're asking right at the moment as a test bowler, like Cummins is probably the safer bet, but Bumrah might still have their higher ceiling there. But if you're talking all format bowler, it's obviously Bumrah. If you're talking cricketer, I think that's when Cummins would probably come back into the conversation a little bit because of the batting and now the captaincy as well. Not that I don't think Bumrah couldn't captain or anything like that, but he hasn't. And he's, you know, outside of that one Stuart Broad over, we all remember, we haven't really seen all that much there. Anyway, that's going to be it. And thank you very much to Anurag for all of his super chats and to Sankulp and Saurabh as well. And everyone else for their questions in the group. I've got Crickfeek and Raghav and a few other people in there as well. Josh and Jessica, QTW and Hypercost was in there as well. But yes, we will be back again for more podcasts very soon. But if you are watching live on the YouTube, I'll be back in like 12 seconds for the scoreboard. So I'm going to go off, powder my nose, and then be back. But for if you're listening on the podcast, remember that you can follow us on Patreon, and all the podcasts will be there. And then we do separate live videos also on the YouTube channel. Good Areas Live, Jared Kimber Live, whatever Muku has called it today. But that's where we're going to end this podcast. I'm probably going to be doing this a lot. We will be making ads as well. But remember, my new book, Overthrowing Cricket's Empire, is out. It's, I think, available in England. I'm not sure if it's available in any other markets at the moment. But it's about English cricket, but from the other side and the teams that beat England for the first time. So it's about England heroes, but just the story is told in reverse, I suppose. Please go and pick up as many copies as you physically can. I'm Jared Kimber. This is The Wagon Wheel, and I will see you again very, very shortly. Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku, as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, you will need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up great clips from your podcast chats and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.